Welcome to Rocket Talk, the Tor.com podcast. I am Justin Landon, your erstwhile host. With me tonight are two exceptional bloggers, and we're going to talk a little bit about the Hugo Award, which I don't think I've talked about on this show for at least a couple of months. My first guest is Renee Williams. She blogs at Lady Business and Strange Horizons and co-hosts the Fangirl Happy Hour podcast. She's the co-editor of Speculative Fiction 2014 and a committee chair for the Organization of Transformative Works. Welcome, Renee.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming back as a repeat guest. My second guest is known only as The G. I like to call him the OG, but we'll just call him The G. He's the head dude at Nerds of a Feather, the exceptional blog, which received my personal nomination for Best Fanzine on the 2015 Hugo Award. He lives in California, and there is literally no other information about him on the internet. Welcome, G.
Thank you very much for having me.
Just, do you need voice change technology? Or you're good?
I could.
we'll leave it alone. We won't take you too far undercover. But Renee, you have been undercover for years as just Renee, and you are now Renee Williams. Welcome out into the world of the internet.
Yeah, no, it's kind of weird, little strange, but it's fine. It's going to be okay.
What prompted you to reveal your name?
Actually, editing Speculative Fiction 2014, my name is going to be on the cover of that book. So I could put it on my resume, and I was like, I can't be on the cover of a book and not just go ahead and out myself. That's just weird. So I just went ahead and did it.
Well, congratulations on that and on Speculative Fiction 2014. I am very excited. Mostly excited because you guys included a piece by me, which, you know, thanks for servicing my ego.
You're welcome.
Yeah. There's Nerds of a Feather in the book?
Yes.
Good. G, do you know which piece off the top of your head?
I do, and I think they picked a good one, so I'm very excited to be in it this year. One of our other writers was in it last year as well, but this is my first year.
It's one you wrote.
Yes, this is one I wrote, but excellent. Last year was one of my co-conspirators.
I'm actually really curious about what fandom is going to make of our table of contents when they announce it. Or at least our contributors, that is.
I remember you saying quite a while ago, Renee, that there was going to be some departures from how the types of things that were included in previous years. Is that correct?
That's a safe bet. Yep. I'm kind of worried about what the SF establishment is going to think about some of the pieces that I chose.
Oh, well, it's fine. But I'm really excited about it. And I know who the editors are going to be for 2015, and I'm very excited about that as well. So. But we're not here to talk about Speculative Fiction 2014 or my ego, although we can stay on that topic if you guys like. But we are here to talk about the Hugo Awards. And there has been no shortage of discussion on this subject going back to November, it feels like. I mean, it feels like it just gets started earlier and earlier every year. And I have had a love-hate relationship with the Hugos over the years. I was nominated last year, which was great and an honor. But I'm always frustrated by the process and by how arcane the rules are and how difficult it is to get people involved because of the cost factor of joining to be a member. But like, this award is such a big deal to the community and such a big deal to the literary community. It feels like it should be easier. Am I crazy?
I mean, I think it depends on what you're talking about participation. In terms of voting, it's pretty simple. You just pay your $40 and you get to do it for 2 years. But in terms of actually being involved in a more substantive way, my impression is that it's extremely difficult to do. And it takes a lot of personal commitment. And you have to be very involved in these institutions of Worldcon and you know, these kind of, I forget what the actual name of it is, but they have these committees that make all the decisions and so forth. I mean, maybe Renee knows a little bit more about this than I do. But, you know, for the limited type of participation that I engage in, which is to nominate and to vote, you have to pay something, but it's not really that much, especially considering that you get some books in exchange. So I didn't think that was too much of a bar for involvement, at least for the type of involvement that I do.
I think you're right. I think $40 is not an absurd bar, but I think when you look outside the United States and outside, you know, the larger English-speaking countries, like $40 is more of a challenge. And I think one of the things we've talked about over the years is trying to broaden the participation to more international voters and that kind of thing, where $40 is more significant in some places around the world. But putting the money question aside for a second, I find one of the hardest problems is just approaching, number one, the number of categories and the difficulty of determining like what's eligible in what category. I mean, Renee, you've been attached to the Hugo Award, personally attached to it for a long time, much the same way that I became personally attached to it, which was like, it's the first thing you kind of learned about genre, right? Because it's this big award. How have you navigated getting involved in these categories, and did you find it off-putting at all?
I didn't find it off-putting exactly. I mostly lurked a lot, which is just kind of what you do when you come into a new fandom. You don't just run in and start, you know, getting loud and obnoxious about it. You just sit and you watch. So by sitting and watching from, like, you know, like the early aughts, I learned a lot just sort of by diffusion, osmosis, whichever one it's you're supposed to use in that situation. So when I finally started participating, it was sort of not straightforward, but it wasn't as hard as it could have been had I just come into it blind like all my friends did who I, you know, bullied into taking part. Sorry, friends. But, I mean, I don't mind the number of categories because I've dealt with it by creating a spreadsheet that I can just, like, have my friends put stuff in. That's pretty much how I learned how to navigate the number of categories and the amount of media you have to sort of pay attention to be able to nominate in all the categories. And I'll also have a pretty zen relationship period with, like, getting involved in every single category because some of those categories I just don't care about at all.
Oh, preach. Yeah, there are several categories I sort of refuse to acknowledge, but it's strange that we have an award where the nominating ballots that are cast, you know, we get, I think we had 1,200 nominating ballots cast for novel last year, and then, if I'm not mistaken, this is again off the top of my head without looking at the numbers right in front of me, I want to say there were around 98 cast for fan artist. I mean, there's a humongous gulf between... to me, that just seems bizarre. It makes me wonder how relevant all the categories really are.
Well, the fan artist category is just sad because there are so many amazing fan artists, but they're largely female fans. They're largely like on DeviantArt and Tumblr. And as far as I can tell, the SF fandom itself doesn't seem to value those people the same way they do people who are, like, in the, like, quote-unquote, in the community. This is going to the gender thing. When Euclase, one of my best fan artist nominees for, like, this year and last year, she had a post on her Tumblr a few years ago saying, when men do art, it's just art. When women do art, it's fan art. If men do fan art, it's art. So I think as fandom has expanded, the fan art has gone down because SF fandom, as I call it, really doesn't value amateur art by women. Because if they did, that category would be super popular. And it's also a marketing thing. They're not bringing in those female fans. Those female fans are going to other fandom communities. They're not invested. So it's a marketing issue as well.
Yeah, there's sort of an insular quality to Worldcon, I think, and you see this even in the large categories like Best Novel, and where you know you can find that there's kind of a, I don't know what the best way to put this is, but there's a sort of a type of work that the people who vote are attracted to, or a style or a taste or something like that, and every year you see the same kinds of things repeating in these categories, and they can be different from category to category. But within a specific category, you keep seeing the same stuff over and over again. And there's not that many huge departures, at least in my experience, or from my perspective. I know nothing about fan art category, and I'm ignorant about, you know, most science fiction and fantasy art, whether, you know, quote unquote pro or fan or whatever. So I can't really comment there so much, but I do think that you get these kind of institutionalized or institutional repetition within the categories in terms of what people are picking. And an aversion to expanding the categories to cover more things and different types of things.
If we recognize that we have some categories that are really popular, some categories that are not popular, one of the things I've really pushed for over the years is that, like, maybe the Hugos need to take a look at their categories and evaluate sort of, like, number one, I think the thing we can all three of us would probably agree on is, like, hey, maybe you need to modernize the categories you have, because some of the things are not terribly relevant anymore. I mean, semi-pro zine, professionals, we don't have a professional zine. It's all very confusing about what fits there and what doesn't, you know. Fanzine doesn't make a lot of sense anymore in terms of people don't know what it is. So do we need to look at changing and adjusting the categories to make them just make more sense? Because I think that's one of the biggest barriers to getting people involved. They look at this ballot and they're like, I don't know what the difference between a novelette and a novella is. I don't know what the difference between a semi-prozine and a prozine is, or a fanzine. Like, they don't know. And so that discourages them getting involved.
I mean, I think that it really, the categories in general need to be overhauled. I mean, there's so many problems in that slate of categories. I mean, one of them you mentioned, which is that things just don't scale. You know, you have fanzine and semi-prozine, and then in other categories, there'll be a distinction. Artist, for example, there's a distinction between fan and pro, but there's no pro magazine, even though professional magazines are a huge deal in science fiction and fantasy. And the fact that there's no award for, you know, that can go to, like, Asimov's or competing with, you know, Clark's World or whatever, is just ridiculous. There's no award for best anthology or collection, which makes no sense to me. Yet there is an award for best long form editor. And I'm pretty sure that most people who vote have no idea what goes into being the best long form editor of the year. You know, and then it's just, the other thing that bothers me, especially about semi-prozine, is the way that they define it, is they put the onus on figuring out what fits into that category on the voter, who has to then try and find out how much money the magazine makes, which is ridiculous. So I think they need a different way of determining what fits in what category that's intuitive. Last year, I suggested some changes, and one of them was I suggested that, you know, perhaps when we're looking at fiction periodicals, we should add a professional category, and then we should talk about, you know, define the professional category by whether it's, you know, SFWA qualifying or meets their standards for being a pro-paying market. And if it doesn't, then it would be, you know, semi-pro or whatever. And that's simple. You can just go to Google and find out what fits and what doesn't. It's, you don't have to go asking everybody and finding out that X, Y, and Z have recused themselves this year, and suddenly this other magazine is making just enough money that they no longer qualify, like Clark's World and so forth. And I look at the Hugo categories, and I think this makes no sense. It's just like, you know, taking things the way they've been done and then kind of adding and adding and adding and never going back and editing anything. And thinking about, does this make sense or does this not make sense?
Unlike everybody else, I don't care so much about the categories. There's a reason for this. I can't influence change in the categories because I don't make enough money to go to the business meetings. So it just does not, it feels like spending my energy in a place where I can't really make any changes to it. So I just don't get head up about the categories. Like, they're the categories we have. There's a system in place to change them, but it's really hard to engage with if you're, like, not super rich, which I'm definitely not. So most of the time I just take it as they come. And if a year comes by and I don't really have anything to invest in a category, I just sort of leave it alone, because I'm sure there are people who are invested in categories I don't care about. So I just leave that to the, like, not the professionals, because that's wrong, but the people who are able to engage and actually change the process, because otherwise I'll just stress out for no reason.
That is an incredibly healthy perspective. But
I know.
Don't you think, I mean, so Renee, you and I have talked about this a lot, about the feeling of ownership of the Hugo.
Yes.
And that we as fans who connected with the award at a impressionable age feel some ownership of the Hugo Award and its importance within our own interactions with science fiction and fantasy, which is something that we clearly love immensely. And this feeling of ownership of the award is very, it's very frustrating to me, and I think to others, that they feel an ownership to the award and that the award means a lot to us and to the community, and yet actually influencing the way the award is managed is really hard and made really hard intentionally to keep control of it.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, I've been in this situation several times where I'm just like, wow, I'd really like to propose a change, but I don't know anybody who goes to these business meetings. I don't understand, like, the whole, the proposal steps. Robert Rules of Order scares the crap out of me. I think what we're seeing is just a marketing issue, right? So, to get people to, like, really invest, you have to give them a piece of the award. You have to make them feel like they have ownership in it. But Worldcon and the World Science Fiction Society has a lot of problem doing this, because the sporting membership, all they can do is nominate and vote on the awards and on site selection. If you really want to get people to buy in and join your club and care about your award, you have to give that sporting membership more influence on how the award is managed. I think there's things in place like I think there's somebody's trying to do that right now. I think they're trying to get it to where supporting members get to vote on things, but I don't know what status that is. But that's what it's going to take to get more people invested. And until that happens, I just don't feel like expending energy is worth my time. Like, I'd rather go read something.
I mean, the impression I get is that they sort of want more people to be involved and they sort of don't. I think, you know, in a sense, Worldcon is kind of, you know, undergoing this transition from the kind of the pre-internet phase to the, you know, internet phase. I mean, it's obviously we've had the internet for a long time now, but with Twitter and with all these other social media and ways to sort of be involved in the discourse, I think, you know, they're getting a lot of input from people who simply weren't giving that input, you know, even 10, 20 years ago. And to a degree, they like that. You know, they like the exposure. They want to stay relevant. Certainly, I'm sure they like the extra revenue, and, you know, the marketing benefits and so forth. But at the same time, you know, Worldcon has this culture of being this kind of close-knit group that makes these decisions. And when faced with the idea that they might have to share that or open it up and cede control, you know, I think that can be quite scary to a lot of people, you know, who feel like they really do own the Hugos and have done so, you know, for a long time.
But I don't have a problem with the way that's set up to make changes. I know it's really hard to make changes, but that's a positive of the system. I know it's, like, financially prohibitive for a lot of people, but it really makes it hard for, like groups of politicized people to come in and just do what they want. Either it doesn't matter if they're conservative or liberal or whatever else, but that system that blocks everybody from being able to just, you know, take over and change things willy-nilly is really good. But, like, supporting members are really important, I think, to the future of the award, because it's supposed to, like, this convention is supposed to move around, and because it can't develop, like, a following when, like, Dragon Con or Comic Con that gets to stay in one location, they have to come up with other ways to develop a membership that is really invested in the award itself and the convention. So until they give those supporting members more of a voice, it's going to be really hard for them to stay relevant, because fandom will just move on without them. I keep saying this over and over, but SF fandom is really, really small. We are not that large.
Right, right. And the Worldcon is like a small within a small. It's this very kind of unique group and tradition within an already small fandom. You know, and that sort of explains a lot, I think, about their behavior. And I agree with you, too, as well, that, you know, they really don't need to change the way they do business. They may want to consider it, like you said, if they want to expand and grow and sustain the prestige and position that they have. But, you know, if they go the other way and they start restricting things more because they don't like, you know, some of the politicized activism, or, you know, people like all of us who kind of, you know, snipe from the wings at times, you know, then, I mean, as much as we're invested in this, you know, people who have been dues-paying members for a long time, they're appreciably more invested in it. So, you know, if that happens, then c'est la vie.
The Hugo Award is to me, it seems, it's much more, it's even a niche within a niche. It's like we're getting into, like, little, what are those little Russian dolls?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly true.
And it's like each one of them is like a nest within it. And the Hugo Award is like the smallest little nest as it is today, at least in participation and like people that are actually invested in the participation of the award. And yet it's the only thing that somebody outside of our community might be aware of, right? Like, I mean, yeah, they're aware of maybe Brandon Sanderson because he's the number one New York Times bestseller, but like it's the only marker in our community that can go on the cover of the book that said that somebody in the, my mother says, oh, I know what that is. Like, I know that's a thing. That's an important thing to win. Just like we know that, you know, in mystery or horror, you know, the Shirley Jackson Award's a big deal or the Edgar Award's a big deal. Like, we know that. We don't have a connection to it, but we know that. And so I think that's kind of been the frustrating part of all of this is that we want the award to not stagnate, because that's my fear. My fear is that the Hugo Award stagnates, and that due to the ability of relatively small populations to control the outcome of an award, whether through rules constructs or through voting blocks, are able to influence the ballots to the degree that people who would participate stop or never consider it because they don't feel like it's actually representative of anything. And if that happens, then we lose what I think is one of the great ambassadors to the genre in a time where I don't think we have a lot of ambassadors.
It's a marketing problem. Again, it always, cause it just goes back to the marketing. I don't really understand, and it's just probably because I'm not really a member of the SF establishment, but I don't really understand why they don't use the Hugo Award as a marketing tool itself to support Worldcon, because it's a satellite body. Like, I don't understand why they're not doing more to update it, to bring it into a digital, like the digital age, because it's still sort of stuck in the past. So, because they haven't done that yet, because this hasn't been updated, because they're not reaching out using the award as just a thing that fans can do who love science fiction. Not just Worldcon, but let's just love science fiction, because they're not doing that. We're falling into this situation where these small groups are, trying to stomp it. Like, I guess. I don't know. Like, it feels like they're trying to, like, celebrate it in quotes, but what they're really doing is making it irrelevant. Because, like, last year I had several of my friends take part, and after the whole Set Puppies thing, they're like, I don't want to do this again. That was just miserable. I was miserable, and I didn't have fun. And they quit.
No, but so the Set Puppies thing is going on. We all know about it. It is an organized effort on the parts of some people to... And getting away from the political nature of it, I mean, there is obviously a very political nature, but at the end of the day, it's a group of people trying to get their friends nominated to make a point. Right? That's basically what's happening.
Yeah, they said it. Like, they wrote it on the internet in text.
Right. Now, we also know that, like, there is a huge number of people that publish their ballots that are very influential people. You know, I mean, even at the lowest end of the influence spectrum, somebody like us posts our ballot and says, these are the people we're supporting. I probably have three people who trust what I say and that may nominate the people that I suggest. As you go up that scale, there are, you know, people who have more influence. Chuck Wendig or John Scalzi or Mary Robinette Kowal tweet that this is the person they're supporting. Like, that makes a difference, and it can guide their fans and how they might nominate. Not maliciously, but there's no question that these voting, I hesitate to call them voting blocks, but these voting encouragements have the ability to really move the needle on the Hugo Award in a way that other awards don't, just because of the number of nominators. That's something we should be worried about as fans of the Hugo, right, G?
Yeah, I have some mixed feelings about this kind of this trend, because I think that you know, I'm thinking about Sad Puppets. I just want to say one thing quickly just to clarify. I'm not sure if their slate is really only about politics. I mean, I think there's a selection element, political selection element to what goes on there, that they're specifically looking for things that are either, you know, politically conservative by political conservatives, even if the story itself isn't terribly political, you know, or something that they feel has been overlooked by Hugo voters because they perceive a political bias. But at the same time, I think some of the stuff they're also nominating because they think it's good. I mean, they genuinely think it's good. And I saw there was the Charles Gannon book also was on their slate. It was also nominated for a Nebula. So, you know,
I've actually read the Charles Gannon books. They're actually pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that, and then there's also a Jim Butcher book on there, and, you know, I haven't read it also, and I did read the first one. I wasn't really a fan, but, you know, I recognize that he's hugely popular, and that most of the people who are reading his books are not particularly politically motivated one way or the other. They read it for escapism, essentially. I don't want to kind of quite reduce their perspective to just politics, but it's certainly, you know, their slate is very political. And, you know, Abigail Nussbaum brought this up on Twitter the other day, that there's a lot of other types of slates that are also political and, you know, perhaps every bit as political, just with a different perspective or the different, you know, set of preoccupations. You know, it made me think about my own slate that I published, and I don't think I was particularly motivated by a, you know, political perspective when I made my choices. I think I chose what I felt like were the best things I read and the best, you know, stuff I saw over the past year and had some input from the other people at my blog. But at the same time, you know, I recognize that the reason why I like some of these things is because the politics appeal to me. You know, I nominated A Darkling Sea by James Cambias. And one of the reasons I like that is because I think the way he explores certain political issues is very adept. You know, the Andrzej Sapkowski books, the same thing. I mean, they're powerfully political books and they appeal to me on that level. So, you know, even if I'm not necessarily going out there and saying, you know, I want to see more people with my political perspective on the Hugo nominating list, or nominee list, short list, you know, some of those works that I nominated are on there because they do share something with me in terms of political perspective. And, you know, I want to share that with more people, or at least, and kind of get people excited about the same things that I'm excited about. So, you know, I sort of am, to that degree, I kind of think it's fine that they're doing what they're doing, even though I sort of reject the underlying critique of there being this systematic liberal bias in the Hugos. I don't think that's true at all. But if they want to think that and they want to publish a list, you know, of the things that they think are good, then, I mean, you know, fine. You know, I'm not going to follow them in their choices, but, you know, I'm perfectly fine with them doing it.
I think it's not fine what they're doing because of the way they're presenting their list. And I don't have a problem with, like, this year, but it's the fact that they've refined their position, because this is Sad Puppies 3. They've refined their position over several years to become more and more palatable. So they're moving away from the initial political position they were found on, which I think was just one author being mad about military science fiction not getting its due, I guess, and there's a liberal bias and we have to fix it. That was the beginning of this movement, but they've managed to refine it in such a way over the last few years that it no longer looks that way. It just looks like what everybody else is doing. And I just have a really hard time with that, the fact that people are going, no, it's okay, when their premise was so against the spirit of the award.
So I totally agree with you on that point, Renee. I do think you're right. I think they have become more savvy about what they're doing and the way they're presenting their argument and who they're choosing to go on their ballot. You know, I think if you're going to have, you know, throwing in a Jim Butcher and throwing in a Chuck Gannon and some other people that moderate, perhaps would moderate things a little bit. I think you're right. They're becoming more savvy. That's true. And I said, when I said putting aside the political angle, I only said that because we can argue about the politics of it till we're blue in the face. And I don't know that it really addresses any issue. Like, I don't like their politics, so I'm mad at them, which is fine. It, just as they don't like the politics of some of the more progressive people in the genre, and they're mad at them, right? Like, that's going to happen. Like, oh, you can't stop fringe elements from being fringe, right? Like, people who have strong feelings about how things should be are going to advocate for them, right? Like, we can't stop that, nor should we. Like, I think it's generally healthy for that to take place. But what the problem becomes is 50 years ago, when the Hugo Award started, there have always been voting blocks, right? But it was harder because they didn't live near each other. They communicated through paper mimeograph things that were mailed around the country. They only got together once a year. The dialogue was infrequent. Now the dialogue is constant, imminent, in each other's faces. We can share information in real time. So things like voting slates are no longer, or organized voting structures are no longer like casual things. They become formalized informally because of the ease with which we communicate and the disproportionate amount of social power that people have on the internet who have platforms, right? Like, I just think the internet has changed the game with the way the Hugos vote and the way they nominate. And I don't think there's been any accounting for that within the structure of the award itself.
Well, the structure of the voting, I think, has a lot to do with it. You know, I think we spoke about this a little bit earlier, but it's sort of semi-open, semi-closed, which means that you don't really need that many people in order to skew the results. So, I mean, I don't know how many people voted for. You said there were, what, the nominees for fan artist. I don't know how many they had, but I know that last year, A Dribble of Ink was the fifth most nominated fanzine that who eventually won. But in the nomination phase, I believe they had 53 nominations.
Correct.
And the one that was number six,
Banana Wings and the Drink Tank.
Both Banana Wings, that's right.
Yeah, both
49.
Got 49.
Like that?
Yep.
So four people essentially made the difference between, you know, a fanzine making it or not making it. So I don't know how many people the, you know, Sad Puppies can muster, or how many of those people are going to vote the whole thing, or if they're just going to vote best novel like a lot of people do. But it's not going to take that many to really kind of skew the results there. And, you know, essentially, you know, if this is successful, then, you know that the same thing is going to be coming from another direction as well. There's going to be a sense amongst people on another part of the political spectrum that, well, we have to organize in the same way. And then what you end up happening is have competing blocks and this sort of kind of, I don't know what you'd say, kind of ill-defined center that's sort of trying to nominate whatever they want, but it increasingly feels alienated from the process and, you know, gets sort of put into a funk, so to speak, and kind of starts checking out a bit. And I think that's the danger. But this is a danger that's inherent in the way voting is institutionalized. And if they want to change it, if WorldCon decides that this is a potentially a problem, you know, they're going to have to either do one of two things. They're either going to have to restrict the voting just to people who go to WorldCon, which I think nobody really wants, or they're going to have to open it even farther, either by lowering the bar, the cost bar for voting, or allowing people to vote or nominate one of the two elements without paying at all. And that may have the effect of kind of, you know, lessening the influence of sort of organized campaigning. But without those kinds of changes, I mean, I think that this is going to get even more pronounced in the years to come.
And it's here to stay, right? And
yeah, I think so, yeah.
And I think that's the kind of the solution that I've been chasing through this whole conversation, which is if we're aware that the Hugo has some challenges moving forward into the future, the solution is to grow right. The nominating base, to grow the voting base. And I think, because you can't stop people from being people, right? And at the end of the day, like, I don't, I mean, I'll be honest. I organized organized, quote unquote, not to the degree that I actually organized, but there's no question that bloggers got together and said, we're going to win fanzine. Right? That happened. Let's not pretend that it didn't happen. Like,
it totally happened.
Bloggers talked to each other and they said, we are going to nominate each other. Not like, I'm going to nominate you and you're nominating me, but like, we're going to nominate blogs and we're going to nominate the blogs that we think have a chance to win because they have a big enough platform. Right? Like, that happened. I don't think it happened formally, but it absolutely happened informally through discussions and through Twitter. And we've seen that change take place on the ballot. Like, blogs win fanzine now. And I don't know that a traditional fanzine will ever win again.
Right.
Which I think to the World Science Fiction Society and the Secret Masters of Fandom, and I use that term lovingly, are scared of that and should be, because it's an erosion of their culture that they've established over many years. And so I think the only way to solve these problems is to grow the fan base to the degree that these factions are just a small segment of the larger population.
I mean, you know, I think that may be a reason why they might restrict voting, though, too. You know, I think that they like having the revenue from the supporting members. They like the idea of the marketing benefits and involvement. But, you know, if there's a sense of the kind of the turf being stepped on or being threatened, ownership being threatened, then there could be a push from within the organization, you know, to dial back participation rather than expand it. And I think that would be the wrong direction to go in, obviously. But I can see that as appealing to some of the people who are, you know, in on the inside.
Well, that's all a little bit doom and gloom. But I think we can all say, all three of us, even after all this commentating, I think we all legitimately love the award.
Yes, and love griping about it as well.
Complaining about it incessantly on our blogs.
Yes.
But we complain about it because we want it to be good. Like, we have an emotional connection to it. I know I do. I wouldn't talk about it so much if I didn't. And so with that in mind, I think I want to play a little game with you guys. We have lots of categories. We don't have to touch on all of them, but everybody's been talking about what they're nominating, right? They put their slates out there. This is what I'm nominating. This is not their slate, their suggestions. This is what I'm nominating. This is what you should consider, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's all well and good. You can all go to our blogs to find that out. What I want to talk about is, as three people who are into this deeply, I want to prognosticate. I want to play some prediction games. We are roughly 1 month away from the announcement of the shortlist. Voting closes tonight for the nominations. And on April 15th, we're going to find out what was nominated. So I want Renee and the G and me to, that rhymes, Renee, the G, and me. That could be like a law firm, a really bad law firm. But we should predict what is going to be on the ballot. And I think, well, rather than doing a long list, I want us each to predict one person in each category except ones that we don't know anything about. Deal?
Deal.
Renee?
Sure.
I feel like you're not as excited as I need you to be.
This sounds hard. This sounds difficult.
All right, we'll just see how it goes. All right? So we're going to start at the bottom and we're going to work our way up. So, John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer. Give me a prediction and why. The G.
I'm going to go with Django Wexler because I think he'd be someone who's deserving. I think he's written some great books, very careful, interesting, historically inspired fantasy books. I have no idea what goes into, you know, winning the Campbell, but somebody that, you know, I voted for or nominated, so.
What do you think, Renee? Anybody there that you think will be on the ballot?
I haven't been paying close enough attention, but I actually think that Octavia Cade might have a chance. I've been hearing a lot of buzz.
That would be great. Her book, novella, Trading Rosemary, was magnificent. And I think she'd be a really good choice. I think she's got a pretty good chance. Part of the problem is it's a pretty light Campbell ballot this year. Like, there aren't a lot of big names, you know? So I will predict the easy one, which is Wesley Chu. He's the only one that was on the ballot last year that's eligible again, with the exception of Benjamin Sridhar, but I think we can recognize there are probably some challenges with her returning to the ballot. So my gut says Wesley Chu will be there. We often see people that are on 1 year come back the next year for a second stab at it. So I'll go with Wes. Fan writer. Renee, who's going to be on the fan writer ballot?
I'm pretty sure that Boz is going to make it again. Boz Meadows.
All right, G?
I'm going to go with this guy named Justin Landon.
Whoa, hey there.
I just got incestuous.
Yeah, it did. I was number 6 last year. I was like 20 away from making it. I don't think that'll happen this year since I closed my blog this year, but you know, you never know.
But you are on my draft ballot, well, so I'm not just pulling this out of nowhere.
Thank you for massaging my ego as we talked about at the beginning of the show. I will predict Natalie Lurs is going to be on the ballot. She got suggested by Scalzi last year. She got 34 nominations last year. I think it was the first time she'd ever been on the short list. She had a huge year. I mean, she blogged about, you know, the Requires Hate stuff. She blogged about all kinds of convention drama, and really, like, what I called her, the consummate fan writer, because it wasn't about, like, books. It was about, like, fan culture. And so yeah. I think she's got a really good chance to be on there.
She's on my list as well, and she wrote a piece called Silence is Complicity, which is about the Marion Zimmer Bradley scandal. And that was really just, you know, kind of, you know, tore my heart in two, because I loved Mists of Babylon when I was younger. And I thought that was really well done. I mean, she's a great writer, and she's done a lot of, you know, good work over the past year, and, you know, she'd be very deserving if she won.
I agree. Renee, do you have a fan cast that you think is going to be on the ballot?
Yes. Really hoping that Speculate SF.
I love that show.
Because I just feel like this year I've just been seeing them everywhere, mentioned all over the place. And I didn't get that last year, and then they weren't there, I guess. So I just feel like they've been doing some really, really good work.
Yeah, I think that's good. That's a good prediction. It's kind of crazy because there were 7 on there last year, so it's kind of hard to figure what's gonna make it this year. G.
Well, I mean, this is the category where I really have no idea which of the podcasts that I like are eligible or not for this category. One that I'm sure is eligible, and could very well be on the ballot would be Skiffy and Fanty, which is quite good. You know, and there's a number of others that I like as well, but I'll pick that one.
Yeah, I think that's a good guess. The tricky thing with this category is, like, Sword and Laser, which just missed the ballot last year. Like, I'm pretty sure they're not eligible, but we won't know until they're actually nominated, which is really annoying.
It's really frustrating, right? It's super, super frustrating.
It is very, very frustrating. I will predict that Galactic Suburbia returns again on the ballot. They're very popular with the...
They're so great!
Yeah, and they're very popular with the Hugo crowd. They're also good. I mean, they're international. It's all women. They have a great show. Like, I think they'll return on the ballot. But the one podcast that I can't believe hasn't made the ballot is Mer Lafferty's I Should Be Writing, because it's like one of the longest running podcasts, hugely popular, but it's never made the ballot. So what can you do? Best fanzine. G.
Well, I'm going to keep it in the family, so to speak, and say it's going to be Lady Business.
That makes me so, like, that makes me so nervous. I'm just so anxious.
I actually parsed some of the number. I used the Feedly, number of Feedly follows as a proxy, and you know, it's interesting. You can see, sort of get an idea of how relative size of certain blogs to another. And I think, you know, A Dribble of Ink is obviously a lot bigger than a lot of the others, but the fact that they won last year, you know, I'm not sure if they're gonna repeat on the ballot, but you know, I feel like this could be Lady Business's year.
Well, thank you for thinking of us. I don't know. It's really hard because two of our blogs graduated, right? They left us. They left us behind to go to Semiprozine. So it's really difficult now to know who is going to be on this ballot. I actually think that there's probably going to be more traditional fanzines, but I don't know which ones because I don't read them because they're hard to read.
I think that's actually a really good prediction. So the Book Smugglers and Porno Kitsch have now gone up to Semiprozine due to paying for fiction. And then you look at A Dribble of Ink, which barely made the ballot last year, despite winning in a walk. So, and I haven't seen his name listed on a lot of ballots that have been floating around there, despite his popularity. So if Aiden didn't make it, I would be surprised, but not stunned. And so, and my blog, which I think got about
You're still eligible?
I am still eligible, but I got about half as many nominations as Aiden did last year, and given that I closed the blog, it's just, it's very unlikely that would happen. So I actually have no, I think you're right, Renee. I think we're going to see more fanzines on the ballot this year.
Which it's fine. I have no problem with that.
I think that's, like, I think that's healthy.
Go read them.
The big question will be SF Signal. I don't know if SF Signal has withdrawn themselves this year.
They're going to withdraw.
Because they have a new editor, right? John DiNardo.
They do.
But not for this year.
Yeah, right. It's next year when they'll probably be eligible again.
Okay.
Or at least they'll decide that they're eligible again.
I mean, so basically we're gonna play ping pong with traditional fanzines and blogs.
That said, the big test case here will be if Elitist Book Reviews makes the ballot again.
They will.
All right.
Which they will.
They will. I mean, they have a readership beyond.
They do.
The Sad Puppies thing.
Will they get the blogger vote? And I think that's the big question. We will see. I will be very interested to see how that plays out.
I mean, I think the big argument for the traditional fanzines is that, you know, there's going to be a smaller number of voters this year compared with last year because that was in London.
So tremendously smaller, I think, yeah.
Especially in these categories. So, you know, I think that's absolutely right that there should be at least two traditional fanzines on the final ballot. You know,
I could see four.
I think Aiden's going to be on the ballot again. I mean, I think that winning last year was a big boost in his profile. It's just an amazing blog. You know, every time I read one of his reviews, I get reviewer envy because it's just, they're so well done.
I know that feel.
I mean, it's just so like, I just sort of like want to throw my computer and be like, why am I even doing this? But I don't because I love reading the reviews. I mean, they're amazing. But, you know, I feel like he's probably going to make the list again. I don't know if he's going to win again, but I think he'll be one of the shortlisted ones.
All right. So, semi-prozine, any feels in this one? I don't have any feels.
I just want Strange Horizons to be there.
Yeah, I mean, they'll be there. I feel pretty confident that they will be on the ballot again. The rest of them are all kind of, it's like the huge, you know?
It's hard because I mean, you could predict, like, you could be like, oh, Porno History of Book Smugglers would be great, but they're really new, like, to that category.
And they're both UK-based, which is, at least partially UK-based in the case of the Book Smugglers. I think it's going to be really hard. I do think the Book Smugglers have a chance. They have an enormous profile. And they've launched their publishing arm this year. It's gotten a lot of buzz. I think they have it. I think I would be willing to predict that the Book Smugglers will be on here. But the question is, who do they knock off? And so I think, with a lack of UK votes, I could see Inner Zone falling off, and I could see Strange Horizons losing votes, but they'll probably still be there. And so, you know, are we going to get six nominees again? And if we do get six nominees again, then I could see Book Smugglers being on there, because I don't know, if you look at the six, Strange Horizons, Lightspeed, Apex, Beneath Ceaseless Skies, Inner Zone, and Clark's World, there is no seventh. There really isn't a seventh magazine that has a big enough profile to really jump into that, I don't think. So it'll be interesting. I think there's a chance. We'll see.
Is Beneath Ceaseless Skies, do they count as a semi-prozine still? I'm not sure if they do or not.
If Lightspeed does, they certainly do. But I do think there was question about whether or not last year was Lightspeed's last year as a semi-prozine. Right. And Clark's World too has been in question about whether or not. So
they're not. Neil told me that on Twitter at one point.
Okay. So maybe we will see some real change over here. You know, Goblin Fruit, Amal Elmatar's magazine, has been really close in years past, so that'll be interesting. She's a darling of a lot of the nominators, so we'll see.
If I'm trying to prognosticate here, I'm going to say if Lightspeed is eligible, they're on. If they're not, I'm going to go with Beneath Ceaseless Skies. If we're going to go with, you know, who I think should be on there, I'm going to go with Inner Zone. I think Inner Zone is amazing. And I think it's undervalued in the community for how good it is and consistently good it is.
That's what everyone says. I hear that a lot.
There's a news agent near where I live where they carry the print copies. So, you know, I buy it every once in a while and I just read it cover to cover. And the nonfiction stuff is almost better than the fiction. Even the fiction is great.
So, best professional artist, are we expecting any new names here? This is a category I pay a lot of attention to. I don't know if either of you do.
I do, sort of. I'm just kind of bad at it, because professional artist seems really dude-heavy in this
field. It is very dude-heavy.
So, I don't, like, person I think that will probably end up there is, like, Galen Dara.
Yeah.
Because she was nominated last year. So, I feel like she'll end up there again. The person I want to be there, who probably won't be, because the universe hates me, is Joey Hi-Fi.
Well, I was going to mention him in a second. What do you think, G?
I know nothing about this category. So.
Here's the thing. There are four names that are going to be on the ballot. Slam Dunk, they're there every year at this point. Julie Dillon, John Boccaccio, Galen Dara, and Dan Dos Santos. So basically we're talking about one other spot. John Harris is he's a British guy. You know, I think he was greatly aided by the UK vote last year. Fiona Staples is Saga, and I don't know what Saga's eligibility this year is. I'm sure it's eligible, so she may be back. But Joey Hi-Fi only missed by one vote last year, so one nomination ballot last year. So I think he's got a chance. The problem is, again, we're going back to the U.S., and so a South African artist who's mostly been published in the U.K. What his popularity will be is, I think, hard to say, but. I think we're talking about one spot being available. So we'll see where that goes. Best editor short form. I think we've only had like 8 people ever nominated for this category. but I anticipate a new name this year. Do either of you?
I don't know enough about it because I'm bad at short fiction.
G?
Good question. I mean, all the people that I was sort of thinking of are the usual types. Did you have somebody in mind? Or?
I think Bill Schaefer is going to make it this year. Bill is the
Subterranean Magazine.
He is the editor-in-chief of Subterranean Press and Subterranean Magazine. He's basically been keeping the novella alive. I mean, he publishes all of K.J. Parker's novellas up until Tor.com is going to publish one next year, or this year. He publishes, Caitlin Kiernan and a lot of more literary stuff, a lot of collections, a lot of anthologies. I mean, he absolutely qualifies across the board for the magazine, for his collections, for the novellas that he does. So I think he's been huge for actually keeping novellas alive because they don't work online, really, because they're so long. So these online magazines, like novellas, are a hard fit. And so I think he's been hugely influential. Also, Subterranean Press, I think, has been hugely influential in the way we think about books as artifacts and that kind of stuff. So I don't watch television, so I don't have any feelings on Best Dramatic Presentation Short Form. I don't even have a prediction, because I wouldn't even know what to predict.
I watch television. I just don't know if I watch the right kind of television. Hugos tend to favor, like, Doctor Who, Game of Thrones. I don't know if I want to say more serious genre television, but like I watch like Sleepy Hollow, and my favorite genre television show is Teen Wolf. So
I'm not really sure that I'm
qualified.
Oh, you're qualified. You just have a different taste than the Hugo.
I have a prediction of the last episode of Korra, The Legend of Korra.
I think that is a good guess. Very good guess.
Anything? I'm really intrigued
Anything?
To see if that happens.
I haven't really watched a lot of speculative television over the past year. I mean, I watched Gotham and liked it, so I guess I could say that. But I mean, I don't really think it's going to be on the ballot. I mean, I guess the safe thing would be to say something with the words Doctor and Who.
You're both fired.
Doctor Who's going to be on the ballot. Game of Thrones is going to be on the ballot. But I do think that the season finale or the series finale of Legend of Korra has a chance. It was the season Legend of Korra beginnings was 15 votes from being on the ballot next year, so or last year. So I think that series finale got a lot of play. Hey G, do you want to just take a little walk while we give Renee a few minutes to talk about Captain America?
Yeah, I was about to say, I'm pretty sure I know what her nominee for long form dramatic
that's not what I was going
hey,
to
Hey, Renee, choose. What do you think will be on the best dramatic long form short list?
Interstellar.
Oh, God, no.
Way to take the wind out of our sails.
Oh.
I'm sorry. Like, no, I've heard so many predictions. I've already predicted this category in my head to my friends. Like, it's going to be like Interstellar, the Lego movie, Guardians of the Galaxy, Edge of Tomorrow, and then something else that's not Captain America 2 like it should be. So bitter.
I mean, Iron Man 3 made the ballot. Surely Captain America 2 will make the ballot.
I don't know. It's just because I want to say that we were sort of spoiled for choice last year in movies. There was a lot of good stuff that came out.
There was.
So, if Guardians of the Galaxy was super popular and it's liked for good reason, if that makes it, are the voters really going to give another Marvel movie a nod? Like, that's my worry. Like, the doubling up on the Marvel movies.
Well, Guardians really fits, I think, with the taste of the average Worldcon voter, where it's sort of semi-serious and semi-silly and kind of snarky and so forth. It's stylized, and I think there a lot of the books that Worldcon voters like, and the writers they like, also kind of have a similar approach to that, which I guess you could say, I don't know how to describe it, but sort of like, you know, a Firefly approach, except of course with Guardians, it's more tongue in cheek, more comedy and so forth. But there is sort of a mixing of kind of action and comedy and, you know, seriousness and comedy and so forth. And I think that's a shoo-in. You know, there's no doubt that that's going to be nominated. Whether that pushes out Captain America 2, I don't know, even though Captain America 2 was, in my opinion, the better of the two movies. We'll see.
Well, everybody will know if it doesn't get nominated, because you'll hear me screaming in agony.
Yes, yes. But I mean, I think my big preoccupation with this category is that whatever wins, it just better not be Interstellar, because that was just so terrible.
I just started a war. Perfect.
Oh my God, what an awful
so much
movie.
Hate mail.
I know. But I'm unabashed about my distaste for this film. I mean, I thought it was beautiful. I thought the music was great. But the screenplay, I mean, I go to see movies when I can, at a theater nearby that has it's got a 70 millimeter screen and a geodesic dome. It's full of people who work in the industry. Many of them have been drinking for a few hours before they go see the film. And there were two points in the movie when the audience erupted in, derisive laughter at some of the dialogue. I mean, there was that Anne Hathaway speech. And I mean, people were just openly just laughing at the movie. And that sort of summed it up for me. You know, I know a lot of people like it, and I respect opinions that are different from my own, except for on this film.
All right. Best graphic story. I don't read graphic novels.
This is so disappointing.
What, you do?
Yes. Yes.
That's great. That's why you're here. Predict.
Miss Marvel, Volume 1, No Normal.
Yeah, that's a good prediction.
I'm going to go with Lock and Key, Alpha and Omega by Joe Hill and Gabriel Rodriguez. I think, you know, Joe Hill, obviously, is a name familiar to people outside of comics fandom. It's also a very good comic. And the other guys in my blog who do the comic reviews regularly, Mike and also Vance and Philippe, they can't get enough of this series. So
I will predict Howard Taylor's Schlock Mercenary gets back on the ballot. He was not eligible last year because he didn't have a book come out. Like, it was just the webcomic, and webcomics generally are not eligible by themselves, just as a webcomic, but he had an actual book out this past year, and so that the title is escaping me at the moment of that book, but I think he will be back on the ballot. Best related work?
I'm going to go with Call and Response by Paul Kincaid. I think, talk about critics, you know, operating on a high level. I mean, he's, you know, the best, and or one of the best. And, you know, I just think everything he writes is just fascinating. And he really, if there's any justice in the 2015 Hugos, really that should be on the short list.
Should be and will be is a challenging question.
Yes.
Renee.
Yes.
This is a really hard category. Catch-all category that I found super frustrating.
Yes, it's annoying.
I
does not excuse you from giving a nomination.
I'm thinking. It's really difficult. This category is hard. I actually think that Tropes versus Women series by Anita Sarkeesian, her women as background decoration, has a chance this year because of all the, you know, the drama with Gamergate that series got a lot of play
Is the series still going? Like, is she still doing it? It's not.
She's still making videos. Okay. I mean, she's still making videos. It's just a long series because she got so much money. She got to expand the series into all these videos. But that specific, like that specific women as background decoration, was just really excellent. And I feel like it has a pretty solid chance.
Yeah, it got 23 last year. So I think there's a pretty good chance it could jump up. I think Sibilant Frictive by Adam Roberts has probably a better chance than Paul Kincaid's book, only because Adam Roberts is also a published author, of fiction. And so that just elevates his profile a little bit. Also a book of criticism, that he put out. And I think Adam Roberts is friggin' hilarious while he's being critical and incisive. So, I'll go with Sibilant Frictive as my prediction on that category. So, the next three, novella, novelette, and short story, maybe you can just do it all at once. I will admit that I don't read short fiction until ballots come out because there's so much of it that I find it overwhelming. And so I wait for all the awards ballots and then I read based on award ballots because I just can't keep up. Please tell me you guys read throughout the year.
I do. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
Oh, good.
Sort of.
Good. Why don't we just do all three at once? G, what do you have for these three?
All right, so let's start from small to big, I guess. For best short story, I'm going to give you two. What Glistens Back by Sunny Moraine and 4 Days of Christmas by Tim Mon, which were both amazing. For best novelette, I am going to go with We Are the Cloud by Sam J. Miller, which I think is probably going to win. At least that's my feeling. It's a great story and it's very popular. Novella is one where I didn't really read a lot of stuff, and I'm going to go with a bit of a controversial nominee here, and I'm going to say it's going to be Scale Bright by Benjamin Sridwankeo. I hope I'm not mispronouncing her last name. I probably am. Controversy aside, I mean, it's a really good piece of writing. I read it quite a while ago, but it's very, very good. That's who I think may be on the ballot.
Well, for short story, I'm going to predict that She Commands Me and I'll Obey by Anne Leckie may be on the ballot, because it was posted late last year as part of Strange Horizons fund drive, mm-hmm. and she was already surfing on her Hugo win, and I feel like there was a lot of attention on her name, so I think that might be likely as a possibility. For novelette, I'm just going to cheat because it was on the Nebula ballot. Tom Crosshill's The Magician and the Laplace's Demon, which was really excellent. And I see what's on the Nebula ballot. But I just think because the Nebula and Hugo overlap so often, I just expect it to be there. And then for novella, I haven't read this one, but I've heard about it over and over and over. Mary Rickert's The Mothers of for Hisville. I don't know how to pronounce that word. But that novella.
And that was on Tor.com, and mm-hmm. I think it's like the longest thing that Tor.com has ever published. Like, I think it was almost a novel. It was so long. I will say that I think the Anne Leckie is a pretty good guess. I think that's a good one. I also think the Sam Miller story, G, is interesting because he's also eligible for the Campbell. And if he gets nominated for a novelette, I feel pretty confident that he would probably also be nominated for the Campbell.
Yeah, that may be the case.
So that's something to think about. And then best novella, I lied. I did read one last year. It was in the middle of the year. It was Trading Rosemary by Octavia Cade. And she has been getting a lot of talk, so I'm crossing my fingers on that. Unfortunately, it was published by Mask Books, which is an imprint of Prime Books, which is a pretty small publisher. And it didn't, you know, it wasn't released online. It was, you know, sold as a book. So I think a digital book, I should say, but I think that may be a challenge for it, where all these others are kind of available for free, but it's getting some buzz, and you know, we know it doesn't take a ton of ballots to get on these nomination ballots, so hopefully that one has a chance. So, we're on the big one. Best novel. Now, each of us could probably pick 5 novels that we think will be there, but let's pick one, and let's each try to pick a different one. And Renee, you can start. What do you think is the novel that you think is going to be there this year?
Ancillary Sword by Anne Leckie. I'm pretty sure. It's got to be there. It's got to be there or else I'm going to revolt.
I think a pretty safe guess, given how successful
I'm just
it was.
Really nervous, though, you know, because I don't... When I first posted about my nomination ballot, I was just like, well, should I put this book that I liked on there, or should I read more stuff since I know it's going to get nominated? With the book in question was Lock In by John Scalzi. And I'm like, because he's obviously going to get nominated because it's him. But then, you know, Joe Sherry turned around and told me, don't ever assume that something is going to be nominated just because it's, like, popular or whatever. But in this case, I really think that it's safe to assume that Ancillary Sword is going to be there because it's perfect. It's a perfect book.
Uh-huh. It's very good. I much preferred Ancillary Justice, but yes, Ancillary Sword is also very good. G, what do you got?
I think actually both the books that Renee mentioned are pretty solid bets, you know, both Ancillary Sword and also Lock In. I'm going to go with City of Stairs, and I feel like City of Stairs is actually on the cusp of being in or not being in, but I really think this is a book that should be nominated. It's a, you know, fascinating take on epic fantasy that really just disposes with most of the tropes and goes in unusual directions and almost seems like it's the first book I've read in a while that is epic fantasy, but it feels free from the straitjacket of that subgenre. Very well written, very interesting. I really want to see it on the ballot. I'm not entirely sure that it is going to be on the ballot, but I think it should be at least close, and I'm hoping it can make a good final push.
I expect it to be close, but I think, like you, I think that it's not going to make it. And I think the same is true of Goblin Emperor, which is another book that I really want to be on the ballot, but I think it will fall short. And I think both of them are going to fall short for the same reason, which is fantasy doesn't usually make the ballot. And when it does, it has to kind of be a transcendent fantasy book, I think, to make the ballot. And I think those two are good enough to be transcendent fantasy books, but, you know, it's not the Wheel of Time in terms of popularity. It's not, Storm of Swords by George R. R. Martin. I mean, it's just, I don't think they're big enough. And so I worry that they're not going to make it. My guess this year, is that the James S. A. Corey book from this year, which is titled Cibola Burn, which I think was a return to form. I think Caliban's War is one of the best science fiction novels of the last 10 years. I think it's amazing. I thought Abaddon's Gate was pretty underwhelming. And I think Leviathan's Wake made the ballot.
It did.
Caliban's War did not. Abaddon's Gate did not, but still had a pretty good showing with about 70 nominations. I think it's got a really good chance. James S. Corey is very popular, I think. And with the Expanse TV series coming, at least the buzz of it, I think it's got a pretty good chance to get nominated. And given the buzz of the Expanse, I think we'd have a pretty good chance to win. I don't know when the Expanse debuts. I have no idea.
I don't know either.
But if it were to come out in August, that would certainly aid their chances, perhaps, in winning. But yeah, I think they'll be there. And there's a ton of books that could be here that I would sure like to be here. This is an interesting year. I think you're right that we have two locked in. John Scalzi's Lock In and Ancillary Sword, I think, are very probably 80-90% chance to be there. And then we're really talking about three spots.
Never make assumptions. It's dangerous to make assumptions.
The best part about this conversation, it's already done, right? All the votes have been made. So
Chaos Horizons doesn't have Lock in the predicted five.
Nope.
Who does he have in?
He has Annihilation, Ancillary Sword, Monster Hunter Nemesis by Larry Correa, which I think is a very good shot at being on there as well.
Yep.
Goblin Emperor, and his argument for Goblin Emperor is essentially that, you know, it's either going to be that or City of Stairs, and Goblin Emperor has momentum from being on the Nebula list. And then his fifth one, which is the one I don't agree with, is that he thinks Skin Game by Jim Butcher is going to be on the list as well. And I just don't think that that's going to be the case. I think that's where you're going to see Lock In taking that fifth spot.
Is Skin Game the one that the Sad Puppies are pushing?
Yeah, I mean, I think his argument is basically just that, you know, Butcher is popular, they're pushing it, them pushing it, plus him having at least some fans within Worldcon, it will be enough to get him on the list. There's a compelling argument, but it's also, I mean, I don't know what number it is in the series, but it's far from being the first or second in the series. And
I mean, I think
I'm not sure if that's going to be.
It's like the 14th.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
And it's fantasy, and like, you know, fantasy's a challenge. But I think if you look at Larry Coria, you know, he got 184 nominations for Warbound last year. Well, what is Larry Coria's non-Sad Puppy fan base? And he's been on the short list or on the long list before. And I think it's been somewhere around 80 or 90. And so to catapult him up into the 184, I estimated there were around 70 Sad Puppy, like really 70 really dedicated Sad Puppy voters last year.
Right.
That was the Vox Day number, but Vox Day got 69 nominations. That's probably the core, right?
Yeah.
And so you're looking at 70 nominations. Does Jim Butcher have, and it's probably only going to take 80 to get on this year because we're going to see less ballots. So maybe 90, something like that.
Right.
So does
so
Jim,
maybe both of them could be on there.
They could be. I mean, I'm not, it's, but I think to leave off Lock-In seems strange because Scalzi is openly saying he's eligible, which he did not do last year for the human division.
He's almost the ultimate Worldcon novel choice as well, because I mean, I've been thinking about this, you know, what, you know, he's nominated frequently. What do he, Seanan McGuire, Connie Willis, you know, people who keep getting nominations have in common? It's that there's sort of a sensibility to it where it can be read as straight adventure, but there's depth there, and there's sort of, you know, often this kind of cleverness to it, that's a bit playful. In a sense, I guess that's when I think about Firefly. I think about it's a similar sensibility to that. And I think that's very appealing to, voters, Hugo voters. So I think Lock-In has a very, very good chance of being on the list.
You can't also discount the fact that all those authors you named are entry level writers. Like, if you have a baby genre fan and you go, hey, you want to read some genre, here is, you know, McGuire and Scalzi and Willis. Oh,
totally.
Yeah, no, I agree, but I think the thing about those writers is that there's also a little bit something else there, like with, you know, the Old Man's War books, which I really enjoyed. You know, you can read them as just, this is this adventure story that's kind of Heinlein-ish and so forth. But then when you read a little bit more closely, you see that there's a lot of sort of subtle critiques going on there that, you know, someone who is a dedicated fan can really get into. So they're accessible, but there is depth. You know, there's depth there, which other entry-level texts perhaps don't have.
And Scalzi's book plays with the gender of the narrator, which I think in the current climate in science fiction and fantasy is something that people are very interested in.
Right.
And so I think he gets to that next layer of saying this wasn't just another Scalzi book. It was another Scalzi book with this interesting thing that people talked about, you know, the multiple narrators on the audiobook, like really from a appealing to the Hugo voter, he's catching a lot of different niches within the Hugo voter base that will be interested in that book. It'd be hard. I would be stunned if Lock-In wasn't on the ballot, but
yeah,
but we will see. This has been a long chat about the Hugos. Thank you both for giving me so much of your time, and we got pretty serious at the front end, and then we kind of had some fun here at the back end. But thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Rocket Talk.